Specializing in contracts, commercial law, and and medical ethics, the subject of the class this afternoon. After a distinguished career as a rabbi in Silver Springs and as a world-renowned lecturer on rabbinic authority, Rabbi Breidowitz made aliyah to Israel and is rav in Or Sameach in Yerushalayim. He has published widely on Jewish law and ethics, and it's a great honor that he is here today. I would also point out that as the co-director of the curriculum department in JLI, I've been in touch with Rabbi Breidowitz when we were producing the renowned JLI medical ethics courses, one was called Medicine and Morals, and one was called Life in the Balance, and we relied on Rabbi Breidowitz's wisdom and guidance, and therefore I very much look forward to hearing from him on this particular topic. Because there's a lot of important information that Rabbi Breidowitz would like to convey, we're only going to have 5 minutes at the end for questions. We'll get a few of them in, and then those that remain, Rabbi Breidowitz will take after the session. So I think we can.
Hi everybody, welcome, and it's certainly a great honor for me to participate in the Chabad National Retreat. I had noticed only 2 people were enrolled, so I guess those figures are a little misleading. I also want to congratulate Rabbi Ginnerman and the whole JLI staff for the outstanding work that they do in so many subjects. And I certainly was very, very impressed with the high level of biomedical as well as halakhic expertise that they brought to the preparation of their materials. The subject that I was asked to address are some aspects of cloning and stem cell research in the eyes of halakha. Let me first begin with a very general point. And the very general point is we sometimes hear from the religious world, primarily the fundamentalist Christian world, that all of these different technologies are problematical because it is wrong to play God. That, as it were, you know, God created the world a certain way, and we are not supposed to interfere with it. And I just want to suggest that in the eyes of Jewish tradition, that is a bit of an oversimplification. In fact, if one may counter one cliche with another cliche, not only is there nothing wrong with playing God in some sense, but in fact, that is actually one of the meanings of man that is created in the image of God. That Judaism believes, of course, that God runs the world. Judaism believes that God is the source of healing, the source of success, and the source of blessing. But emunah, faith in God, in the Jewish tradition, is not quiescent, it is not passive. We don't simply say if there's sickness, God will take care of it. You also have to go to a doctor and take the necessary preventative steps. God gives us parnasa, God gives us the way to make a living, but we have to work. Maimonides writes, Maimonides of course was himself a great doctor, that he who basically says, I will not go to the doctor because God will heal me, is like a person that says, I will not eat food because God will feed me. Well, yes, God feeds you, but you've got to put the food into your mouth. I'm sure you've heard over the years the famous joke, although after Katrina it's not so funny, about the righteous man that was trapped in a flash flood, and the water was getting higher and higher, and the boats came by to rescue him, and he says, I don't need your boats, God will take care of me, and the helicopters came with the rope ladders and the airplanes. And the water gets higher and higher, and he first leaves the porch and goes into the house, and then he goes to the second story, and then he goes to the attic, and the water is going higher, and he's declining all assistance. He finally goes to the roof. But as the water is going to submerge even the roof, he finally calls out to God in his final moments of life, and he says, I have been your faithful servant for so many years. Why have you abandoned me in my time of need? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded, I tried to save you 5 times. Who sent the helicopter and the airplane and the rope ladders? How did you expect me to save you? By splitting the water? That happens once in a while. But generally speaking, we're not allowed to rely upon that. As a result, therefore, the concept of faith in Judaism is not inconsistent at all with medical technology and progress and the bold use of whatever science can help us do to achieve beneficial results for humanity. We need to work with humility. We need to understand that God is in charge, certainly. But God has empowered us, as it were, to control and manipulate the elements of creation that are necessary to bring healing and goodness into the world. Without getting too far afield, that is the great metaphor of circumcision, because people say, if God wanted Jewish men to be circumcised, why did he create them uncircumcised? And part of the message is, God left the world in a state of incompleteness so that we become his partners in completing creation. That is even the spiritual mission of the Jewish people. That is the nature of the oral law and the idea that the sages and the Jewish people become part and parcel of the implementation and the creation within the halachic process. So as a result, one cannot simply dismiss technologies by banalities or generalities such as it's wrong to play God. We certainly have a halachic structure, and the halachic structure gives us do's and don'ts. But even that is somewhat complicated, because you're going to have to think about this. We have two different halachic systems. We have the 613 commandments, which are the halachic system that is binding on the Jews. And then we have the seven Noahide laws, which is God's revelation that is binding on the Gentiles. So it's a very fascinating question. When we ask ourselves, what is the Jewish position regarding anything, we actually have to answer two questions. What is the Jewish position vis-a-vis Jews? And what is the Jewish position vis-a-vis the world? What is the universalist message of Judaism? And sometimes the answers will not be the same. Something might be improper for me to do as a Jewish person, but it might be something that is societally okay. And occasionally you may even have the reverse situation, although that's very rare, where something might be societally interdicted, but may be permitted under Jewish law. So the notion of what is the Jewish position on something is actually a more complicated position than you might think. Moreover, in Judaism we have a very, very rich vocabulary. Things are not just asur or mutar. Asur means prohibited, mutar means permitted. Number one, is something forbidden under Torah law or under rabbinic law? Number two, even if something is permitted, is it advisable? Is it proper? Is it a violation of the philosophy and spirit of Judaism, even if it is not a violation of the letter of the law? There are many things that might be permitted by the letter of the halacha, but they are offensive and detrimental to the overall value structure. So to articulate the Jewish position is a complicated question, but I will try to at least be very, very selective in addressing certain aspects. Let me first start off with stem cell research. Cloning is indeed a very, very interesting subject, but that is less in the realm of practicality than is stem cell research that is actually going on. And what is the basic concept of stem cell research? Well, very, very fascinatingly, in every single cell of the human body, there actually is the entire genetic structure of the entire human being. So you take a skin cell. In the skin cell is the genetic code, theoretically, for liver, heart, kidney, brain. And what happens is, in the course of embryonic development, there are certain switching mechanisms on and off, in which when the cell becomes a skin cell, the other things become dormant and they shut off, and the like. But initially, when you have fertilization, when the sperm fertilizes the egg, you have a blastocyst, it begins to divide. The cell has not yet differentiated and specialized in any particular way. It becomes, as it were, a generic cell. It is just a cell that is not yet specialized. It is a stem cell. actually, to use the very, very beautiful description of Mary Travers, you know, the famous singer of Peter, Paul, and Barry, who tragically died of cancer, but she spoke about stem cells because she was treated with stem cell research. She said, a stem cell is a cell that hasn't yet decided what it wants to be when it grows up. And that's as good a definition as any. And basically, stem cells exist in various forms. There are adult stem cells that can be found in bone marrow. Each of us has still stem cells that have not yet differentiated. There are cells in placentas. But the most common and most fertile source of stem cells, many researchers feel, is what are called embryonic stem cells. And that basically are stem cells that are harvested from early term embryos within a week or 2 weeks after fertilization, typically in an in vitro fertilization procedure. And around 15 to 20 years ago, it was discovered that these cells could be cultured into stem cell lines. And through proper direction, they could turn into any one of the over 200 types of different cells in the body. So, for example, stem cells could be cultured into heart valve tissue, into spinal cord tissue, and the like. Now, let me point out that in theory, although we're not there yet, in theory, one would be able to use stem cells to create whole organ systems, meaning the same principle that says that we can create heart valve tissue from stem cells would also indicate that we could create hearts from stem cells, which indeed would be very, very interesting if that were to happen, because that would alleviate major ethical and economic problems in organ donation, in which you would no longer need a donor of an organ. We could create the organs from stem cells and the like. But as I say, we are not there yet, although this is certainly within the realm of a technological possibility. So stem cells have already shown tremendous promise, both adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells. They have been used to treat illnesses, and there are many, many promising avenues of stem cell research that will continue to unfold with time. There was a controversy for a number of years in the early years of stem cell research. Around 2001, it was overshadowed by 9/11, but if you recall, the big news story prior to September 2001 was the whole issue under the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, whether the federal government would fund embryonic stem cell research, because the problem basically is that in order to get embryonic stem cells, you have to have embryos. And in the course of harvesting the embryos would typically be destroyed. And as a result, the pro-life lobby and the Catholic Church were absolutely against the harvesting of embryonic stem cells. And George W. Bush initially announced that the federal government would not finance, would not support any biomedical research, that it would involve the harvesting of stem cells. And he limited federal funding to existing lines that had already been harvested on the grounds that federal money was not going towards the destruction of an embryo. Many people thought that was ethically problematical. If you're against the harvesting of stem cell research, why do you pay money for people who already did it? We can leave that ethical discussion aside, because now it is basically historical, only of historical interest, for two reasons. Number one, as would be expected, Obama simply changed the rules, and now the federal government does indeed fund embryonic stem cell research. But number two, what happened in science is very, very interesting, and that is stem cell research is potentially so economically lucrative that even if the federal government wasn't funding it, there are oodles and oodles of private money, private venture capital, and state funding that goes in to facilitate stem cell research, as well as international money. And indeed, a number of biomedical firms do not even want to take NIH money, because NIH money requires federal oversight and federal bureaucracy. So in fact, unlike the situation perhaps in the 1970s, 80s, and even early 90s, where if the government didn't fund certain research, it wasn't done, that is very definitely not the case today, where private money is a very, very, very dominant player in stem cell research. So the issue I do want to discuss is this. The Catholic Church has taken a very consistent position. Everyone knows the Catholic Church obviously considers abortion to be the equivalent of murder, and the Catholic Church has taken a definitive position that life, human life, begins upon conception, upon fertilization, and as a result, harvesting a stem cell from an embryo, even if it's 1 second after fertilization, is considered to be murder. Again, one has to have a reality check here. Typically, it's not going to be totally microscopic, but basically the size of the embryo at some point might be not much bigger than a pencil point, and that's what we're talking about. And the Catholic Church considers such harvesting to be a murder, and therefore they will not support any type of use of embryonic stem cell research. Now, obviously, keep in mind that the issue in the United States is not interdiction. Nobody can prohibit stem cell research if, after all, we allow abortion. As long as Roe versus Wade says that you're permitted to have abortions until the, at least certainly during the first trimester, with virtually no regulation, then it's obvious you cannot prohibit stem cell research. But the Catholic Church does feel that it is ethically and morally evil and cannot be countenanced. Again, I don't want to do Catholic bashing, I just do want to point out one inconsistency. Even before stem cell research, there were really thousands and thousands of embryos that were languishing in freezers that would often be disposed of by flushing down the toilet, because ever since in vitro fertilization, there have been surplus, surplus embryos that were not implanted. Now, it seems that one might make the following argument. If we would talk about a campaign like Adopt a Road, you know, adopt an embryo, give an embryo a chance to live, bring the babies to full term, I could understand at least the consistency of the argument. But if indeed you're simply against stem cell research, the consequence of that decision is not that babies are going to be brought to life that would otherwise die. Rather, the concept is, instead of using stem cells for medical research, they're just going to be flushed down the toilet. Now the question becomes, are you honoring life by making a decision in that direction? Meaning, to oppose stem cell research and at the same time not create some mechanism for how these spare embryos could be given life seems to be simply removing any potential benefit from an act that would otherwise be immoral. Now, one might say in defense of that position that if an act is immoral, maybe you shouldn't give it a hechsher by getting something good out of it. You know, that might be an argument, meaning if it's evil, let it remain evil, but at least it would be an ethically questionable position. So the question I want to address is, how would halacha approach the issue of embryonic stem cell research and the harvesting of stem cells if it results in embryonic destruction? So first, let's start off with some basic principles. We know that halacha is against abortion. That's absolutely clear. And not only is abortion considered to be sinful from a halachic Jewish perspective, but abortion is subsumed under the Noahide commandments. It is considered to be a subcategory of murder, and therefore abortion is normally prohibited from our perspective, even for non-Jews. It is a universalistic law that God does not want us to destroy fetal life. Now, interesting, this is not a share on abortion. I just want to point out that the actual theoretical basis of the abortion prohibition is not at all very simple. The Catholic Church treats a fetus as equivalent to human life. Halacha may not automatically do that. Halacha does not regard abortion with the same severity as murder. So there's some question exactly how to explain the abortion prohibition. Is it a form of murder with a less strict punishment? Or is it not murder, but it is simply the frustration of a potentiality to life? Meaning, the theoretical point, which I don't want to belabor too much, is that the halachic rules against abortion are not predicated on a fetal personhood concept, but are more predicated on a fetal potential concept. Meaning to say that true human life does not begin until birth, but the Torah requires us to respect the potentiality of that which may develop into life in the future. So it is not based on actual fetal personhood, it is based on the protection and respect for potentiality. Yes?
Maybe a moot point with the development of pluripotential stem cells, adult stem cells. The group of people who are using this most are in fat tissue, plastic surgeons like myself. We're not there yet, but we're getting pretty close.
Yes, so the question is, I'm sorry, the question is what?
Any discussion about using embryonic stem cells, they prove to be moot.
Oh, yes, 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 no. 100%, yeah, you know, you're actually 100% correct. And in fact, that is very, very true. There is tremendous, tremendous potential in adult stem cells, which I say pluripotent, meaning they can become all sorts of configurations. I heard a talk by a heart surgeon who has employed adult stem cells for heart valve replacement very, very successfully, and he felt there was no need to get into the ethical problems of embryonic stem cells. And you are true. Now, we're not quite there yet, and researchers always want to keep all of their options open, so we need to talk about this. And as I say, this analysis will have some practical ramification, even beyond stem cell research, as you will see. But your point is certainly very well taken. So we start off in halacha with the notion that abortion is considered to be a wrong, a sin. There are heterim, there are dispensations if the mother's life is in danger. And halacha does include psychological trauma as being potentially life-threatening. That's very important. So, for example, how would a halachic scholar analyze the tragedy of a pregnancy through rape and incest? Now, sometimes you'll hear a pro-lifer say, I am against abortion except in the case of rape or incest. Well, in some ways, that's logically incoherent. If one considers the fetus to be a person, to be a baby, how can you make a rape or incest exception? Could you kill a baby if a baby was born as a result of rape or incest? Certainly not. But the way halacha would approach it is, halacha would not carve out an automatic rape or incest exception. But halacha would say that the trauma of the tragedy of rape or incest may, in certain circumstances, be a life-threatening scenario. And if it's life-threatening, we can do what we need to preserve and protect the mother's life. If it's not life-threatening, then we consider other options. Meaning, you're not focusing on the externality of the situation. You're focusing on the particular physical and psychological condition of the woman that's been victimized, and an assessment would have to be made. And let me emphasize, this is not simply a rabbi you call in the yellow pages and the like, but this is something with the family, with the physicians, you know, one makes a very, very serious assessment. Ultimately, it's the woman's decision. It is the woman's decision. But in terms of halacha, it would be based on pikuach nefesh. It would not be based on a rape or incest. So, if we start off with this idea, to be simplistic, abortion is normally not countenanced. How would we apply that paradigm to embryonic stem cell research? Does that box us in to the position of the Catholic Church? So let me present three halachic arguments that would differentiate stem cell harvesting from abortion, which would therefore provide a legitimation, a potential legitimation. Argument number one is the following. There is a statement in the Talmud that an embryo within the first 40 days of conception, the first 40 days of conception, is treated as mere water. It does not yet have the status of a human life. Now, I'm sure many of you have heard this quoted many times. I want to make a very crucial point. One always has to look at the context in which a position is expressed. The statement in the Talmud that an embryo within 40 days of conception is mere water is not made in connection with abortion. That is not what the Talmud is talking about. The Talmud is talking about a very, very different problem, and that is simply the law of Leviticus, that a woman after childbirth, whether it's a live birth or a stillbirth, must bring a sacrifice 41 days after delivery for a boy, 81 days after delivery for a girl. Why does she have to bring a sacrifice? So the Gemara tells us, because undoubtedly the pain of labor made her swear she would never do this again, and therefore as an atonement for taking such an oath, she must bring a sacrifice. But the Talmud says, if the miscarriage or the discharge was so early, obviously there would be no recognizable fetus or embryo even, but it was so early that it was within 40 days of a conception, it doesn't count. Now, contextually, that passage has nothing to do with abortion. However, some halachic authorities have taken the position that although there's no automatic thing called first trimester, we don't go with that at all, but some have said an abortion, quotation mark, that is so early that it is within 40 days of conception is not halachically an abortion. And based on that, things like the morning after pill would be halachically permitted, even if it acts as an abortifacient. And stem cell harvesting would be permissible as well, because obviously you're harvesting the stem cells prior, much earlier than 40 days of embryonic development. Halachically, that might be a basis. But let me point out that the great, great posek, Rav Moshe Feinstein, considered to be one of the great rabbis of the 20th century, adamantly said that there is no halachic differentiation between pre-40 days and post-40 days. And if you think about what I said earlier, you can see why this must be so. Because the most you can say is that prior to 40 days, the fetus does not have the status of a person. Okay, that's fine. But you'll recall that I pointed out that the prohibition of abortion is not based on the fetus being a person. It is based on the fetus or the embryo having the potential to become a person. Based on that, the pre-40 days and the post-40 days is not relevant, because even if it lacks the personhood that would obligate the woman to bring a sacrifice, the laws regarding respecting life are still going to be there. Now again, I should have added at the beginning, I'm not here today to give you any practical halachic advice. If any of these questions are practical, one should be sure to talk to their Orthodox rabbi for halachic guidance. But all I can say is, there are some opinions that have used the 40-day guideline. I'm not going to deny that. Rav Moshe Feinstein has rejected it. So based on his analysis, it would not be possible to justify stem cell retrieval on that halachic basis. Let me mention halachic theory number two. Abortion is prohibited, but abortion is allowed in order to save the mother's life. In other words, mother's life has priority over fetus's life, because mother is actual, fetus or embryo, if it's early, is just potential. So here's the argument. Could one simply say the following? Yeah, harvesting of stem cells is an abortion. You're killing an embryo. But so what? You're killing the embryo in order to do life-saving research that could save a life. If abortion is permitted to save the mother's life, why can't abortion, or in this case, harvesting of embryonic stem cells, be permitted to save the lives of patients who are going to benefit from stem cell retrieval? Meaning, you're not denying the fact that it might halachically be an early-term abortion, But you have the heter of pikuach nefesh. Well, once again, there are a number of reasons why technically this may not be a proper halachic justification. And let me just mention a few things. Halacha differentiates between what you might call therapeutic intervention and experimentation. We know halacha says we violate the Shabbat and we violate kosher and we violate Yom Kippur to save a human life. All of us know that. In fact, I shouldn't even use the word violation, because the same God that says keep the Shabbat and keep the kashrus and keep Yom Kippur when human life is not in danger requires and demands that we violate, again, that we not keep the Torah in order to save a life. Now imagine this. Imagine that I want to do something like attend a lecture of a very prestigious doctor, because I may pick up information that will enable me to save patients in the future. So I want to drive to that lecture and I want to violate the Shabbat. I can't violate Shabbat because maybe I'll pick up some information that is going to help me later on. There has to be a chola lefanino. There has to be an actual person who potentially can benefit. It doesn't have to be a certainty. Even if it's a very small chance, even if it's only a 1 in 1,000 chance, but it has to be therapeutic. So number one, a lot of stem cell work is experimental. It does not necessarily go into an actual patient, etc. So as a result, the abortion rules cannot be waived for experimentation. But number two, there's a more conceptual problem with the pikuach nefesh argument. And the conceptual problem is the following. One might ask a very fundamental question. You're telling me abortion is prohibited, but I could kill the fetus to save the mother. But if abortion is prohibited, why should the mother's life be better than the fetus's life? Why do I say kill the fetus to save the mother? Why don't I say let the mother die so the fetus will be born? Under what principle do I favor the life of the mother over the life of the fetus? So there's a fascinating... Now this thing is undisputed. The Mishnah clearly says we favor the mother over the fetus. That's not a question. But there is an argument between Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi and Maimonides, what is the basis of that favoritism? Rashi makes the argument, which is really what I said before, that since the fetus is only a potential life, and the mother is an actual life, the actual takes precedence over the potential. That is Rashi's halachic explanation for this law. Maimonides apparently does not accept that. Maimonides would put the potential and the actual on an equal footing, and you normally would not be allowed to sacrifice one for the other. As a result, he is faced with the question, so why am I permitted to kill the fetus to save the mother? So Maimonides develops a fascinating theory that if the mother's life is endangered by virtue of the fetus is called a rodef. Now the word rodef means the pursuer, and this is simply a well-known halacha, that if somebody, it's really the right of self-defense, that if somebody is trying to kill me without justification, I or anyone else is permitted to kill them if that is the only way to eliminate the threat. Now, when we think of a rodef, we commonly think of an evil person, like a mass murderer, etc. We don't think of a little baby as a rodef. But Maimonides says, you can be a rodef even without malevolent intention. If the nature of the birth process is going to kill the mother, the baby is the source of endangerment, and Maimonides' argument is, the baby The unborn. The unborn baby may be aborted, may be killed, because if the unborn baby is endangering the life of the mother, the unborn baby has the status of rodef. So again, it's very important that you see the difference here. According to Rashi, the justification of the abortion is the needs of the actual override the right of the potential. According to Maimonides, actual and potential would theoretically be equivalent, except for the fact that the baby is the source of the endangerment. The baby has the status of a rodef. There's a story in the time of the Holocaust about Jews that were hiding in a bunker, and the Germans were looking for them, and a baby started crying. And the story goes, it may be apocryphal, that the mother tried to silence the baby, and accidentally and tragically the baby was smothered to death and died. That's an awful story, but now I'll make the story more awful. According to halacha, and God forbid we should ever, ever, ever have to be faced with such a situation, according to halacha, it may very well be that the baby could be deliberately killed. Because if the baby's crying is endangering the entire group, the baby would halachically be a rodef, and the baby could be killed if there would be no other way to spare the group. If you have a lifeboat that can only hold 10 people, and some 11th guy jumps on the lifeboat, we can throw him over. Now, that's only if we know who the 11th guy is. If you just have 11 guys, you don't know. Each one could say, hey, you jump, not me. We wouldn't be allowed necessarily to make the choice. But if we can identify who number 11 is, even if he's not the heaviest one, but if he's the one that is the straw that breaks the camel's back, he does have, or the people have the right to throw him over. Right? These are very difficult, tragic situations. Now, let's apply this argument between Rashi and the Rambam to the harvesting of embryonic stem cells. I made the argument, well, even if we assume that the harvesting of embryonic stem cells is abortion, perhaps it should be permitted because you're using the stem cells to potentially save lives. Well, that would work only if you follow Rashi's definition that the needs of the actual override the potential. But if you follow Maimonides' rule, that the only reason why the fetus can be aborted is because the fetus is the source of the threat. Well, if this guy has Parkinson's, this petri dish is not the one that's giving him the Parkinson's. There's no way you can define the embryo as a rodef to the guy that has the illness. And therefore, according to Maimonides, you would not be allowed, that would not be a halachic basis for abortion. And I have to say that the Shulchan Aruch, the definitive code of Jewish law, when it codifies the ability to abort in order to save the mother's life, utilizes Maimonides' reasoning of rodef, which would therefore suggest that pikuach nefesh is counterindicated as a halachic justification. So I've mentioned two possible arguments. Again, I'm not here to decide. One is the pre-40 days, and the other is pikuach nefesh. But let me mention a third argument, which indeed does have halachic grounding and has been accepted. And this is very, very significant. If we go back to the predicate that the halachic prohibition of abortion is not based on fetal personhood per se, but it's based on potentiality, so the argument could be made the following way, and again, great poskim have seen it this way, that the laws of abortion, even if they kick in immediately upon conception, only apply if the embryo or the blastocyst is in the environment through which the normal passage of time will cause it to develop into a human being that is capable of being born. That is what is called a potential. An embryo in a petri dish an externalized embryo. In fact, some researchers even use the term pre-embryo, although that's perhaps a euphemistic term, is not yet in an environment where it is capable of developing into a human life. Now, at some point, when we have artificial wombs, things might change, and then you'll have some very difficult problems to consider. But at least at this point, it is not yet in its potential. So the argument goes that the laws of abortion cannot apply until there is uterine implantation, which is the environment which can bring the embryo to fruition. And at that point only does it have the status of a potentiality which may be respected. Now, this opens up some very, very interesting halakhic avenues. And again, I do want to repeat that any practical decision must be discussed with a religious and highly competent, you need both conditions here, Orthodox rabbi. But this goes beyond embryonic stem cell research. This opens up the whole area of pre-implantation genetic screening. Let me give you a very concrete example. We know that there are, of course, genetic illnesses, and some genetic illnesses are linked disproportionately to the Ashkenazic Jewish community. The most outstanding example is, of course, Tay-Sachs disease, a very, very awful illness that basically, as far as we know at this point, there is no cure, and the children will commonly die after a great deal of suffering, die at a relatively young age. We have in the Jewish community, and this perhaps is a subject for another talk, screening programs where before people get married, they can be screened, because once again, Tay-Sachs can only manifest if both parents are carriers. If both parents are carriers, there's a 1 in 4 chance that they will have a child with the disease. But if only one parent is a carrier, then no child is going to have the illness and the like. So there are various screening programs in which, you know, you don't get married until you have a clean bill of health in that way, which could mean that somebody is a carrier, but both of them are not. In other words, something will be certified as compatible if both people are not carriers. They don't even tell you which person. Of course, today, of course, anybody can get that information, but this started at a time when the results of these tests were not so commonly available. Now, let's imagine the following tragic scenario, where a couple got married without utilizing this screening service, and they discover that both of them are Tay-Sachs carriers. What are they supposed to do at this point? So let's just go over options and see what halacha would permit and what it would prohibit and the like. Option number one, get divorced and marry a genetically compatible mate. Well, you can do that, and sometimes that may be the right decision. On the other hand, if a couple loves each other, if they care about each other, if they're committed to each other, no rabbi, no Beit Din is just going to tell them, get divorced. We recognize that marriage is more than breeding machines for children, and therefore the notion that divorce is the panacea to these problems would be very, very short-sighted. Option number two, permanent abstinence, meaning don't have any kids, use birth control, contraception, and the like. Well, number one, there is a mitzvah in the Torah to be fruitful and multiply, to have children. That is the first mitzvah of the Torah. And number two, there's a 1 in 4 chance, meaning 3 out of 4 are going to be okay. And indeed, Jews can beat statistics anyway. In fact, the very fact that we're around means we beat the statistics. It would be a great tragedy to simply not have children. Okay. Option number three, attempt pregnancy. And every time there's a pregnancy, do an amniocentesis. And if there's a Tay-Sachs, abort. Well, let me just say that because of the great, great prohibitions against abortion, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself, has basically said that as tragic and as difficult as it is to bring such sick children into the world, one is not permitted to abort a child because of a serious genetic abnormality. So amniocentesis coupled with an abortion decision would not be halakhically legitimate. So far I've mentioned three options that are really not acceptable. Divorce is certainly not optimal. Permanent contraception is not desirable. Selective abortion through amniocentesis would be a problem of the abortion restrictions and the like. But in light of the analysis I presented with respect to stem cell research, there might be an intriguing new possibility in which all pregnancies could be attempted through an in vitro fertilization procedure, and there might be pre-implantation genetic screening. And if the laws against abortion do not apply to pre-implantation genetic screening, then in effect, those embryos could be selectively terminated without running afoul of the halakha. Now again, I don't want to be cavalier about this. I don't mean to suggest that embryos can simply be discarded like garbage. Certainly, one might say there's an additional option, which you might call the righteous option. The righteous option of the tzaddik is, I accept all that God gives me, the good and the sweet, the difficult. I recognize that God gives challenges to those who are able to live up to those challenges. And under those circumstances, one simply says, I will do what I will do. I will pray for divine mercy. And I will live up to God's challenges with dignity and self-respect and compassion. That indeed is the highest level. That is the level of the tzaddik. However, I do recognize, and halakha recognizes, that psychologically and emotionally, not everyone is necessarily ready to live by that standard, and therefore the concept of pre-implantation genetic screening might be a way in which one might avoid at least the technical abortion restrictions, and this might be a way to deal with serious genetic illnesses. Now, of course, there'll be a little bit of a logistical matter. How do you manage, as it were, to have all your pregnancies in vitro, but at the same time have regular coitus, you know, because again, we're talking about people essentially using this contraception when they are having their own intercourse, and then attempting pregnancies through an in vitro. That's a little bit of a juggling act that would have to be worked upon, especially since condoms per se are not considered halakhically permissible either. So you have to have some type of medical or chemical contraception. At the same time, try to attempt pregnancies through an in vitro fertilization, but that would be the way to go. Let me just see how much time we have. I just want to. Okay, so let me just talk. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about in terms of stem cell research, to be aware of it. And as I say, the importance of the analysis here is not merely for stem cell research, but for pre-implantation genetic screening, which is going to be increasingly important as we identify more and more illnesses that have a genetic basis. Now, let me point out that for illnesses that have a very, very long latency period, which may not develop for 20, 30, 40, or 50 years, it would be kind of idiotic to use pre-implantation genetic screening, because essentially you are terminating a life that could have had many, many, many good years, and by the time the illness would manifest itself, there might be a cure down the pike. So one has to be very, very careful in terms of how this technology is used. Now, when we come to cloning and stem cell research are often mentioned in the same breath, but in fact they are very, very different processes. Typically, embryonic stem cell research is regular sperm, regular egg, in vitro fertilization, and as the embryo develops, until the cells are differentiated, they are simply stem cells, they're pluripotent, they can become anything, and we harvest them. Cloning really involves a step going beyond stem cell research, and that was the following. For many, many years, scientists believed that once a cell has become specialized, meaning once it is no longer a stem cell, once it is a skin cell, a kidney cell, a bladder cell, whatever it would be, specialization was considered to be irrevocable and unchangeable. Right? That was almost an axiom in biology. What cloning taught us was that even specialized cells can be reactivated for the other DNA that is within them. For example, the way this worked, and technically the term for cloning is somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT. Let's take Dolly, right? Dolly was the famous sheep in Scotland. By the way, Dolly knew she was a celebrity. It is said that Dolly became very arrogant because of all of the publicity, and she insisted on covert and the like. So even a sheep, right, even a sheep, you know, gets an ego. So we have to be very, very careful not to get too egotistical and prideful. But what happened was this. A cell, a somatic cell, I think it was taken from a bladder, of a female sheep was taken. An egg was taken. The nucleus of the egg was stripped away. It was replaced by the somatic cell. And so essentially, that was the fertilization. Instead of being fertilized by sperm, in which case the sperm contributed 50% of the chromosomal material and the egg was the other 50, here, basically 100% of the genetic material, other than mitochondrial DNA, but basically 100% came from the somatic cell, which in turn turned into an embryo, which would be a genetic copy of the source from which the cell was removed. So cloning is essentially creating a genetic copy from a single source through the medium of denucleizing, if that's how you pronounce it, denucleizing the egg. And then, of course, it's implanted. People think, you don't clone, you know, if I were to clone myself, I wouldn't go into a drugstore and walk out with two of me this way, but it would be an embryo, a baby that would have to be born after 9 months, etc. And essentially, I would have virtually my identical twin, X number of years younger than me, coming out of the body of a different mother. Wouldn't be this, so essentially we wouldn't have the same mother, but genetically we would be identical. Now you may wonder, what is the purpose of human cloning? Is it just a matter of egotism? I'd like to have two of me, three of me, 100 of me. Keep in mind, some people have posited science fiction scenarios that if we could clone 100 Michael Jacksons, you know, we could create, and I meant Michael Jordan, I'm sorry, not Michael Jackson, but Michael Jackson, Michael Jordan, whatever it would be. We could change the music world, change the sports world. On the other hand, let me point out, economically, if there's 100 Michael Jordans, they're much, much worth less. I mean, the uniqueness of these great figures is because they're so rare. If you have too many of them, they really don't count for very much. Some have suggested that cloning is beneficial because it could be a, not a cure, but it could be a response to infertility. Imagine a person that was castrated, or a man that's not capable of having children, a Holocaust survivor who is perhaps a victim of Nazi medical experimentation. He cannot have a child through his sperm, but through a somatic cell, he could have a child that his wife could carry for 9 months. And although it would be genetically his child and not so much her child, but she would have had the mitochondrial and she would have carried the baby for 9 months. So it's as close as you could imagine to a genetic child and the like. So interestingly enough, you know, post-skim debate this, but many post-skim have said that in principle, there is no prohibition against cloning a human being, except for the fact that we simply don't know what the side effects are, and to introduce new technologies that can have a potentially a tremendous danger. For example, one danger that's been pointed out is that we wouldn't automatically know the genetic age of the child, meaning if you're a cloned child, you might be born 50 years old. DNA is 50 years old, etc. A newborn baby might, in fact, be an old person and the like. So there are going to be different issues here. But I just want to leave you, because time is short and I do want to take one or two questions, with a very interesting question. That is, what is my relationship to my clone? Let's assume I cloned myself. And it's 13 years later, so my clone is now a bar mitzvah boy. I walk into shul. There's eight people in the shul, and I walk in with my little clone. Do we have 10 people? Or is my clone just me? We just have 9 people. So it would seem, once again, the closest analogy to a clone is an identical twin. Identical twins count for 2, as far as I know. So I would assume we have 2. But again, one could discuss this. But here's the final question I want to throw out. And this is a wild question. And that is my clone my son? Or is my clone my brother? Because if you think about this, my clone comes from the chromosomal combination of my father's sperm and my mother's egg, albeit carried in another woman's body. So technically, the offspring of my somatic cell may not be my son, it may be my brother. And indeed, the mother of my clone is not the woman that carried him for 9 months, but his grandmother. My mother is his mother. Now, this is very fascinating, because let's consider the mitzvah of Yibum. There's a mitzvah in the Torah that if a man dies without children, there is a mitzvah on his brother to marry the widow, to perpetuate. Let's say a man dies and he has no children, but he has a clone. Now this is going to be wild. If the clone is his son, then his wife is free to get married to somebody else. There's no mitzvah of Yibum. But if the clone is his brother, he has no children, he has a brother, there might be a mitzvah on this kid to marry his mother, but that's because it's not his mother. Right? His mother is his grandmother. So the issues of personal identity do remain to be worked out. And God willing, next time we have a retreat, perhaps we'll have some more advanced talk about this. But thank you. I think I could... do we have time for a question there?
I think we have to end it now.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyway, take care.
Project for the Regency Ballroom at the Middle of the Service at 6 o'clock.